Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today's episode of the programme comes from Pakistan. I recorded the show at the Lahore Literary Festival. My guest is well known for his ability to translate the complexity of life in Pakistan, especially the criminal underbelly of Karachi, into nail-biting crime fiction. He's served with the Karachi police for 12 years. He's been actively targeted by various terrorist groups and organisations. He was wounded in the line of duty and his office was bombed by the Taliban. He has a master's in criminal justice policy from the London School of Economics and a master's in law from University College London. His first novel, The Prisoner, was critically acclaimed and longlisted for the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature. He's also the author of The Spinner's Tale. Omar Shahid Hamid, welcome to Meet the Writers. Omar, we're talking here at the Lahore Literary Festival. I think for both of us, it's the first time we've actually come here.
That's right, yeah. It's been around for a while, but it's actually the first time I've managed to come up from Karachi.
Despite you being now one of Pakistan's most celebrated writers.
It's, I think, always been a case of bad timing. Either I was caught up in something or work didn't allow me to come, one of those things.
So work is really, really interesting because you're not just a writer. You are, in fact, a serving member of the Karachi Police Force.
Yes, I am a police officer, and it's great for getting stories, for writing, for being a writer. But I think the writing bit is what keeps me sane as a police officer. So it's become a sort of symbiotic relationship now, really.
I'd like to look at your early life and then go a little bit through your police career, which has been really very, very eventful. Now, I think particularly in Britain and the United States, we have perhaps a slightly skewed idea of Pakistan. And until I had come here, I hadn't really seen how much more there was to it than the bad PR that is out there. And I wondered if you could just give me a snapshot of growing up in Pakistan.
Yeah, I think obviously in the last 20 odd years, it's the security headlines that have kind of dominated the conversation about Pakistan. But and I'm not going to say that it's 100% safe place, or it's never going to be Geneva. But coming to your point about growing up over here, it was about as normal a childhood or adolescence as you can imagine. And even subsequently, when we've seen in the last 20 years, the security situation, especially post 9/11, really kind of, fall apart. And especially in Karachi, it was not just post 9/11, but a little prior to that, with the sort of ethnic violence in the city stretching back from the early 90s. There's always been a great resilience about Pakistan and Karachi in particular, in the sense that you could have a bomb blast go off in one part of the city and have life continue as normally as possible in the other part of the city. So I think there's always been a lot of that. And so when you find people coming from abroad for the first time and being amazed at how Pakistan is not teeming with sort of men with guns at every corner. It is. It's part of that life always continues, and probably that's also the case in other places which are driven by conflict, where life does continue. You can have very sort of normal experiences. People go to work, people fall in love, people read books, watch movies. And bad stuff also happens, but it's just taken as part of the deal.
Mm. And in your particular family, describe your circumstances.
So I my father was a senior civil servant who was assassinated when I was still in university. I was studying in the UK, it kind of an event like that changes a lot of things. I think it would be safe to say that I had up till that point a very cocooned upbringing. I was about 19 when this happened, and the kind of fallout from this incident brought me face to face with the reality, quote unquote reality of life.
Why was he assassinated?
He was at the time the head of Karachi's electric supply corporation, one of the utility companies, and there were very powerful political unions who were opposed to some of his policies of retrenchment and going after corruption in that department. And so it was a politically motivated assassination.
And as you say, you were studying away at the time?
In fact, I was in Karachi because I'd come back for summer holidays, but I had been studying I was doing my undergraduate degree at the time.
And what did you study?
Law, funnily enough, which is I've never sort of used it, although it might be funny to hear a policeman saying that he's never used the law, but the law in its formal sense.
So do you think that the circumstances of your father's death is what drove you to join the police force?
That's an interesting question. I think it's something that people ask me a lot, and a lot of people kind of ascribe this sort of bad 80s movie revenge motive to me. I don't think that was the case, but I will say this, that obviously when something like that happens in your life, it has a very lasting impact. It's got a tremendous impact. And what it did show to me was that in a country like Pakistan, where systems are weak, so formal structures are weak, individuals matter more. And so, as a policeman in a place like Pakistan, your ability to do good or bad, depending on your motivations, is far greater than, if you were a member of the NYPD or the London Metropolitan Police. And so, that was one of the things that kind of pushed me to that sort of the chaotic nature of the job and the fact that institutions are weaker and where the individual matters more, that is what it made me get interested in becoming a police officer.
And the chaotic nature of the job, as you say, I mean, you survived ambush, for instance.
I've had a colorful career, let's put it that way. But yes, I've worked in a number of positions in counterterrorism where whether it was sort of gangs or religious militants, because of our actions that were directly against those groups, there's been a blowback. I remember back in November 2010, my offices were blown up in Karachi. I've been shot at. So, it's as a writer, these experiences are great because it's about 5 books worth.
I want to come back to that bomb blast, but I know that you're also implicated in a false case.
Yes, it was sort of very early on in my career, and again, I think it was the point where my naivety as a young, wet behind the ears police officer dissolved rather rapidly, because I was implicated in a case by colleagues. I had to sort of go away to London again for a couple of years until the case was resolved and I was acquitted. But yeah, I think it was, I drew upon some of those experiences in my first book. And in fact, my wife often says is that I started writing The Prisoner, which is my first book, at that time when I was sort of in this kind of self-imposed exile in London, very frustrated with the way that life had treated me and the way that my career had ended up at that time. And so writing started as a cathartic exercise and snowballed into a book.
And of course, there was another major incident which you referred to, which was this bomb blast by the Pakistani Taliban.
Yes, I sort of, subsequent to this case against me, I came back, rejoined the police, being a sucker for punishment, I suppose. And in November 2010, I was heading a unit that was a counterterrorism unit that was responsible for counterterrorism activities in Karachi. And our offices were targeted by the Pakistani Taliban. We were hit by a vehicle, a VBIED as they're called. 20 officers were martyred. And it was just sort of, it was one of those, but for the grace of God moments, because I had actually moved offices the week before. So there was half of my office furniture was still lying in the old office, and we'd sort of moved just a week before when this incident occurred.
And that led to your second sabbatical, if you like.
Yes, it led to colleagues, expressing to me that perhaps it was a it was a good time for me to take a break.
Because you were visibly suffering from trauma from it?
Well, less because of that, more because of the fact that it was made clear to me that myself, personally, I and other officers who had been working with me, my colleagues, were on the hit list of the Pakistani Taliban. And so it was because we'd been quite vocal and quite sort of out there in conducting these operations, which led, as you said, to my second sabbatical in the UK, in London again, which then enabled me to kind of pick up and push on with writing as an alternative career.
So tell me about your book. So your very first one that came out, as you said, was called The Prisoner, and very much influenced by that false case against you. Are you published in Pakistan or in Britain?
I am published in, well, not in the UK, but in India and the US, and there have been a number of translations. So I'm published in Germany, Italy, and France.
And you write in English?
Yes. I write in English. It was always sort of the natural language for me to write in. I've never been particularly good at writing in Urdu. And, you know, I just found English was the best medium for me to express myself in.
Now, you've been described to me as just the best Pakistani genre fiction writer. And I wonder how you came by your particular genre, if you like.
So again, I think this is it was an accidental process, in the sense that one of the things that always struck me in my job as a police officer was these amazing stories that police officers had that we would share amongst ourselves as a fraternity, you know, when we were spending long hours at a police station or at a stakeout or things like that. And they were just, you know, some of these stories were beyond the best fiction that you could ever come up with, but it was a closed world because it was a world where no journalist or writer had access to these, because, you know, police officers being anywhere in the world being a very fraternal or closely knit bunch would clam up in front of an outsider, and there would be very few police officers who themselves would want to articulate these stories for a wider audience. And that's really where, you know, this kicked off. So a lot you know, my books are based not necessarily only on my experiences, but also on the experiences of colleagues and stories and tales that I've come across, told by my colleagues or come across during the course of my career.
And I know that you've now rejoined the police force. How do they feel about you continuing to write these stories inspired by real life crimes whilst you are a serving member of the force?
It's interesting. When I came back from my sabbatical in 2016, my first two books had come out while I was away. So I'd been living in England and I hadn't really been able to judge reaction to them, especially amongst colleagues. But what I found very interesting was that a lot of them, although I kept joking initially that my police colleagues had not really read my books and all, but the more and more I sort of discussed this with colleagues, a lot of them had, and a lot of them appreciated the realism with which you know, the police had been depicted. And if you read my books, it's a sort of warts and all description of the police. I don't try and paint a propaganda picture of them, and I don't paint them as, you know, the devil incarnate either. And I think one of the most gratifying pieces of feedback that I've received as an author is that someone wrote to me on Facebook saying that, you know, I used to view policemen on the street completely negatively and completely differently before I read your books. And after reading your books, I feel that there's another story over there as well. If you read the books, they are far from, you know, a rosy picture. They do not paint a rosy picture of the police at all. They paint what I feel is a very realistic picture. But to kind of get this feedback from members of the public is very interesting and gratifying, because it's certainly not something that I had planned to do. But, you know, it seems to have worked out that way.
And your bosses?
Well, they haven't fired me yet, so they seem, you know, no news is good news. No, I think they do appreciate the fact that in Pakistan the police has a bad rap. You know, it's It's regularly cited as one of the most corrupt organizations in the country. It's constantly looked down upon. And I think everyone who's associated with it is very grateful for, as I said, if not a puff piece, but certainly a fair hearing of their point of view.
Your second novel, The Spinner's Tale, won a major literary prize here. Tell me about the book.
The Spinner's Tale was inspired by a real-life Islamist militant, a man called Umar Said Sheikh, who was implicated in the murder of the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. And Umar Said Sheikh was an unusual militant in the sense that he came from a privileged background. His father was... He was British. He was British-Pakistani. His father had a flourishing business in the East End of London. Umar spent some time in Acheson College here in Lahore, which is one of the sort of premier educational institutions of the country, and went to, I believe it was Mill Hill or Millfield, public school in England, and then went to the London School of Economics. So not what you would expect as the average background of a religious militant. And his story fascinated me, although I never worked on the Daniel Pearl case myself. But the story, and because I was told the story through colleagues who had worked on it, of what would it take for someone who came from a background that, quite frankly, was, I could relate. It was Umar's background. It was very similar to, say, my background. And what would it take? What would be the triggers or the sort of push-pull movements that would make someone from that kind of background become this totally different nihilistic sort of figure? And The Spinner's Tale explores that kind of plunge into the depths of anarchy, if you will, of an individual, of how that individual transitions into something totally different.
How absolutely fascinating. And I mean, it's a question the world is always asking: what makes a religious militant?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I mean, a lot of it was, I was working in counterterrorism, so I was able to interview a lot of religious militants. And one of my questions to them was always this, that I would always ask them about why and how they set upon this path. And of course, everyone's answers were different, but it was just a fascinating study in what makes people tick with regard to this sort of stuff.
I mean, is there any one unifying thing that you can point to? Is it perhaps that people feel not seen, that people feel sidelined?
I think you can't generalize because, you know, it's almost every single case has, every individual who kind of goes through this has their own motivations. I will say this, that yes, there is at times a common thread amongst a lot of such individuals has been the feeling of marginalization in a society. And oftentimes, as in the real character of Umar Said Sheikh and in the character in my book, a feeling of a person who perhaps felt was better than what society was giving out to them. You know, so perhaps that person felt that they deserved more credit or more acknowledgement from society than society was willing to give to them for whatever reasons. And that kind of feeling of, well, you know, I should be a much bigger thing is a trigger. And in other people, I think there's a famous line from the movie The Dark Knight in which one of the characters said that some people just want to watch the world burn. And I think that's true, that in a lot of cases, there are people who just want to watch the world burn.
Do you think that there's a strong link between acts of terrorism and mental illness?
I guess it's sort of comes down to how you define that, how you would define mental illness. But I don't believe, in my experience, that a lot of the young men who get involved in these sorts of acts of terror can be sort of medically termed as mentally not there or mentally ill. I think you can certainly term them as misguided. You can term many of them as sociopathic. But to kind of term them as medically, mentally unstable, I don't think so. I don't think you'd find a lot of people who would. And I think that's the other sort of very fascinating thing, that the people, a lot of the people that you find at the heart of terrorism are very intelligent people who kind of are very aware of what they're doing. They may be misguided, as I said. They may have a very different worldview, but that doesn't make them lesser or less competent.
Tell me about your next book.
So the party worker is kind of it kind of bookended the story that I had began in The Prisoner, because The Prisoner looks at Karachi, the city, this mega city of 20 million that has rampant crime and terrorism and all these problems, but it looks at it from the eyes of the police of that city. You know, it kind of the history of the city is told through the eyes of its policemen. And I thought it would be very interesting to flip that around in The Party Worker, to tell the story of the city from the eyes of political workers. And as you may or may not know, that in Karachi, political violence has often been linked to political parties. All the major parties at one point or another have had political militias that were involved in lawlessness over the past 30 odd years. And so the story kind of flips, you know, what was started in The Prisoner, and kind of looks at it, looks at what the city looks like and what the history or the story of the city is through the eyes of men who kind of got sucked up into political activism, and where that political activism crossed over into political militancy.
Fascinating stuff.
It's a story that I think I felt needed to be told, because as a resident of Karachi, Karachi has had this kind of issue of political violence from the mid-1980s. You know, now we're looking at almost 40 years of a history of violence in the city, and no one's really written about it. You know, I felt that a lot of writers, fiction writers, as well as non-fiction writers who had kind of written before me, and who had written about the city, perhaps focused on a lot more idyllic elements of life in the city. But, you know, in my view, you couldn't live in the city and you couldn't really write about Karachi without writing about this thing that's been there for the last 30, 40 years, which is the violence in the city.
You go on to violence of a different sort, and that's a sport, in your next book, which is called The Fix, and that focuses on cricket. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I think after the first three books, you know, the first three books were very clear sort of genre thrillers, and I wanted to move away. Match fixing in cricket is something that I'm a cricket fan, and when you kind of look at the story of match fixing, especially in South Asia, it's a fascinating morality tale. You know, Shakespeare could have written it. The tale of young men who are bestowed with all the sort of physical attributes and gifts that a young man can be given, who have entire nations, entire countries falling at their feet because of this amazing talent that they have. And yet this, on the darker side, there's this attraction to throw that all away for money. I started researching that, and the more and more I started researching match fixing in cricket, it kind of, you know, it coalesced in my mind that this was the story I wanted to write.
You talk about young men, but of course you focus in this book on a women's cricket team.
While I was researching the book, before I'd started writing, I remember sort of coming across a whole bunch of articles about members of the women's team. And again, what struck me was, and you know, despite being an ardent cricket fan up till that point, I had paid little or no attention to women's cricket. And I think if you were to ask most Pakistani cricket fans, or perhaps cricket fans in a lot of countries, they would say the same thing. It was just something that was totally ignored by the mainstream. But when I started looking into these, when I started reading these articles and these stories, it was amazing, because it was this added element of women cricketers being complete underdogs, never being given a chance by their cricket boards, by their families in many cases, by their peers, looked down upon by their male colleagues. You know, I remember a very famous story in which someone related to me about the captain of the Pakistan women's team being told by a former Pakistani test cricketer who was employed as a coach at that time by the cricket board, and in fact subsequently was also employed as a coach by the England cricket board. You know, and these women were doing some sort of practice or exercise at the National Cricket Academy, and this cricketer said, "Don't waste your time. Why don't you go home and, you know, play with pots and pans or do the cooking or something?" So it's that sort of misogynistic attitudes that were there. So as a storyteller, I thought it would be amazing if I could combine the story of women cricketers rising despite all the odds that are in front of them. And then when they kind of actually succeed in doing that, when they kind of get to the top, when they start winning matches, when they become popular, when the big, you know, sort of contracts and advertisement money starts coming in, they become an attractive target for match fixers who previously have kind of gotten their hands onto the men's game. But because, you know, women, the rise and success of women's cricket makes them a target for those same fixers.
Yeah, and we've just had such a fascinating discussion here in front of a very energized and engaged live audience, all about cricket, about post-colonial national identity, and how all of this works. And it really is desperately important to who we are as nations, cricketing nations, I mean, like Pakistan or like my own Zimbabwe.
Yeah, I think cricket plays, you know, in countries that, and we discussed this earlier at the talk, that in countries that are still struggling to find their identity, in countries that are still, you know, at the adolescent stage of maturity as a country, symbols of national unity or symbols of outward pride become very important. And sport becomes very important because it's a very obvious way of trying to project yourself. And which is why countries like Pakistan, like India, you know, like South Africa or Zimbabwe as well, where sport becomes very important and very dear in the cultural context of the growth of those countries, in the cultural growth of those countries.
What about your own cultural growth? What's next for you?
So one of my things has always been that I want to keep changing what I write about, partially because I get bored of writing the same stuff. It's just more fun to look at different things. So I've started work on another book. This one is a spy thriller. So it's sort of looking at, you know, imagining a kind of classic 60s, 70s, Len Deaton, John Le Carré type world, but taking it again in and putting it in what I feel is the modern Cold War between India and Pakistan. So that is, you know, we are at the Berlin Wall of the 21st century. So I'm working on that now.
The Spinner's Tale is the most recent book by Omar Shahid Hamid. It's published by Pan Macmillan and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Madeline Pollard. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.